My name is Deepika, and I've been living in Orville since 1994. In 94, I came and joined Bernard, and since then, Bernard and I have been taking care of a very eroded piece of land, which is part of Oru Brindavan. We now call it Pebble Garden. That's how it's come to be known. And both of us are working here since 1994. The land is it's about 7 acres, and it's a small piece of Oru Brindavan, which is very large, which is probably more than 150 acres. But we're looking after just the northern corner of Oru Brindavan. The land is really severely degraded, and there's just absolutely no topsoil. And when we came here in 94, we just started, without really thinking of it, we just started looking after the place, protecting it and planting fences, planting trees. And now, after 16 or 17 years, we have about 5.5 acres that is a kind of growing, a young growing forest. We've already planted trees on this side. And in 2001, from 2001 onwards, we started to extend this work and see if we can grow on a severely eroded land, if we can even manage to grow cultivated plants. So our work on the garden area started in 2001, and this has actually become the special part of our work. Because we have set certain principles for ourselves, and we want to build up soil for the garden area. We want to create a fertile garden on this eroded land without bringing inputs from outside.
Without bringing inputs from the outside. Yes, that is a difficult task, I would say.
Yeah. When we started, we didn't know how it would be, how it would turn out, but we didn't think there was any sense in bringing inputs from outside, like for instance bringing soil from outside, because then you dig up another place to revive this one, so that would make no sense at all. And nor did we want to bring, for instance, loads of manure or buy compost from the village or from any other place, because again we are depriving them of manure and in order to enrich this land. So there's no logical sense in that. And considering that there's so much land in the whole country, 50 million hectares is an old figure, but recent figures say maybe 100 or more than 100 million hectares, which is almost one third of the landmass of the country, is in a very degraded condition. And I mean, as we are talking, there's more land going waste, there's more forests being cut down, and if you look at the figures, it's quite shocking. So this is a very serious problem which isn't really being addressed with simple technologies, you know. And we wanted to try this experiment and see if it's possible to do this without bringing inputs from outside, with simple skills, local inputs. Local inputs and just the two of us.
Yeah.
No machines, no complicated technology, and we are just two of us, Bernard and I, and we do all the work ourselves.
Okay, so when you arrived here, the land was totally barren, there was nothing growing. How did you start to make this garden in what it is now?
Yeah, so we figured out a way of doing this by... So the challenge is when there is no soil, when there's absolutely no soil, all the topsoil is eroded and is at the bottom of the Bay of Bengal. So how then can we build soil back? This is the real challenge. And there's only one way of doing it, actually. It's with the help of plants. I mean, soil and plants are actually... They go together absolutely well, and you can't have soil without plants, and you can't have plants without soil. So we took the help of plants from desert areas like the Australian acacias, to be specific, one particular Australian acacia called Acacia coulii. Is that it, Bernard? Acacia coulei variety Holocericea, and among many of the acacias that people like Bernard and all the pioneers who came to Oroville in the 70s and 80s, they were trying so many species from areas all over the world, from desert difficult regions, mm-hmm. and these Australian acacias proved to be some of the best, and they were able to colonize harsh landscapes where even the native trees were not able to survive.
So you started with planting acacias. This made like leaves and twigs. And
yeah, you want to talk
actually about this area had been forested by Peter Clarence Smith in 83. But after he left this place, it was completely destroyed again.
Oh. And by natural erosion?
Well,
or?
No, by the axe.
Okay.
But some of this tree right here in front, the Styracopsis trees, of 4 or 5 trees remained. Mm. The whole area where the Dan is now, there was nothing.
Nothing?
Absolutely nothing. Mm. And there were 3-4 wort trees, big ones, and they were cut the day before we actually fenced the area. Somebody knew about it, apparently.
the approach is basically to use trees like Acacia coulei to start up a kind of to start up the constructive process. So we just broadcast the seeds of these acacias. First, of course, protect the land with live fences. That was one of the first things I did with Bernard when I came here. He was busy planting fences. So I even remember the seeds we were sowing. They were seeds of Acacia mellifera, and he taught me how to dibble them. I knew nothing because I come from a city and had absolutely no skills in this work. So that was an initiation for me. So we protected the land with different kinds of thorny species, and then broadcast seeds of Acacia on the whole place. Also seeds of another indigenous shrub called Dodonea viscosa, and through the seeds. And then we got busy with other things. We were at that time also coordinating a network of organic farmers called Arise. So we did this forest work, the work in the forest, between 1994 and 2001. We did it in between the training programs and in between the outreach work that we were doing under the name of Arise. Mm-hmm. And then specifically for the garden area, We broadcast the seeds of Acacia and let it grow for 2 or 3 years. And these are really amazing plants. Some people don't approve of them because they are exotic, they are of foreign origin, and they consider them invasive. Well, there are many kinds of preconceptions about these trees. But in our experience, our entire garden, whatever you see here and all the plants that are growing, the whole system is completely based on Acacias. Mm-hmm. Because they have this incredible capacity to colonize, to just directly establish themselves on the pebbles without any effort from our part. So we don't need to dig a pit, we don't need to water the plant, we don't need to raise the seedlings in a nursery. Just throw the seeds, and then when the rain falls, they germinate and they survive. And within 3 years, you have a lot of organic matter. So there's a lot of leaves, there's a lot of woody portion, there's twigs and trunk and fallen leaves, green leaves. So it all just emerges from the pebbles almost miraculously. So within 3 years you have all this biomass, which we then transform into, we create garden beds using these acacias. So what we do is we just, after 3 years, we cut back the acacias. In the garden area, we did it this way. We cut back the acacias. We raked all the dry leaves and made a pile. We cut all the green leaves and chopped it up with a machete, everything by hand. We don't use any machines. And the dry twigs we snap. The larger pieces of wood, we keep them aside. Then with the leaves alone, we make layers of leaves and silt. The silt part, the leaves and silt, we make alternate layers of leaves and silt, 12 of each. But the silt component, since we don't have any soil, and there's really just an expanse of pebbles, and this is a it goes down deep. It's not just on the surface. Even 3 meters deep, you find pebbles. So it's not that if you dig, you might find some soil underneath. There just isn't any soil. And so we didn't want to bring silt from outside. That was one of the conditions we set for ourselves. So what we did was we had also created 11 small water harvesting ponds. Actually, some 2 or 3 are quite large. And this was one of the early works that we did after we fenced the place. We created these water bodies. And in these ponds, every year after the monsoon, the rain, flowing rainwater brings some silt, you know, which accumulates at the bottom. And that we scraped. And load by load, by wheelbarrow, we managed to bring it. And we did this layered system of creating beds. With alternate layers of silt and leaves. The smaller twigs we put on the side, the bigger branches also on the side to mark out the bed. So basically we do this layering on the spot wherever we decided to make the garden area. Mm-hmm. 1 square meter at a time we extended the garden.
Yeah. And this system represents a natural system of how the forest would do it.
Well, actually, we were just looking at what happens in a forest. So, small twigs fall to the ground, and after the rains, the acacia starts shedding their leaves, their winter leaves, and then the termites become active, and the termites start crushing the leaves and eating them, and they bring up soil. They bring up particle by particle of soil from between the pebbles and deep down, and cover the leaves with that earth. So if we say that we have the sandwich methods of layers of leaves and earth, it's actually just that we saw that the termites are doing that. Mm-hmm. And we are just doing that in a more enhanced way. Instead of termites being only one layer, we make 12 layers of leaves and 12 layers of that type of soil.
And that's the only material you use in building up the layers?
Up to 5 years ago, that was the only material that we used. But since 5 years, we are using charcoal. So the bigger twigs of the acacia we put on the side of the bed to mark the beds and to protect them from drying out also. And the bigger stems of the acacia we turn into charcoal. And the charcoal, after we crush it and mix it with urine, and in each bed, there are now 3 layers of charcoal, and in the established bed, which we don't turn anymore, they get every year 1 layer of charcoal.
And what's the benefit of this charcoal?
Yeah, the benefit of charcoal. In a tropical condition, you have rainfall in a very short period of time, and the temperature is always high. There is no minus temperatures. So here, for instance, in the area where Orville is situated, even in winter, it's 20 degrees Celsius. So with high humidity and high temperature, there is a very fast mineralization of organic matter. So when this organic matter mineralizes, a lot of nutrients are being produced, and it would be available to other plants. But at the same time, the sky is cloudy. And when the sky is cloudy, photosynthesis is reduced. So the plants don't need that much food when it is most available. So it gets leached out and lost. That's why tropical soils, once the forest is gone, the soils become very poor.
Yeah.
Extremely poor and acidic. Over large areas, the soils become acidic. And when you have charcoal, because charcoal has a huge internal surface. For instance, 1 gram of charcoal has an internal surface of between 50 to 500 square meters. It can store a lot of material. It can store ions. It can store these nutrients which are being broken down in the monsoon. It just sucks them up and holds them. And then when the temperatures increase and the sunshine increases and the activity of the plants increases also, the roots just suck it back from the charcoal. So it's like
it's like a battery system.
Yeah, it's like a battery system. It is charged and discharged. Yeah. So there is no leaching. For instance, everywhere in the red soil area, if you dig a well after some 5, 6, or 9 meters, you will find a layer of white soil. That is the calcium. All the calcium that has leached out from unforested soils. Even in the beginning of a forest, there is still leaching. It's only when the forest is established that this leaching can stop.
That the materials go in full cycle.
I can show you some of the samples that come from the well. You see it's white, it's all calcium or iron oxide or other minerals.
So after the acacia planting, you start to make beds. But how come the garden is now around the beds full green and full alive?
Because by this system of the layered method of building soil, after 3 months, so after you make the layers, you wait for 3 months and let it digest. There's a little bit more to the technique, but basically it's just this. You make layers, alternate layers of leaves and silt, let it digest for 3 months, and then you turn it and it's ready to support any crop. And we, right from the beginning, so we were growing cultivated plants, even things like radishes or spinach and eggplant, everything we could grow after 3 months. That's all it takes. The longer the length of time is to establish the pioneer vegetation. It takes about 3 years for the acacias to grow and to produce enough organic matter to make these beds, but after that it's just 3 months. And you can grow anything on that kind of soil. In the beginning, we did notice some crops were difficult to grow, like cucurbits were a little bit difficult to grow, and some others were easier. But slowly, we found that everything is just improving, and now we find we can grow anything within the constraints of the climate of this place. Obviously, we cannot grow temperate crops here in this tropical climate.
Exactly. But what I meant is, like, you have the beds, they are flourishing, but it seems like also around the beds there is nature and plants growing. Is that true?
Yeah, I think it's once you start creating a small pocket of life, it just invites more life. So, and the way we've made the garden, it's a bit different from other gardens because there's a very big diversity of plants. It isn't just one kind. We have now more than 100 different kinds of plants in a quarter acre. We did the soil building on a quarter acre, and that's the extent of the garden now. And so these, all these different plants, they invite butterflies and bees and different kinds of wasps. And we even use a lot of these small, simple structures, trellises, which invite birds. They come to perch, and there's a whole life that forms around all these plants.
An ecosystem.
Yeah, it's a garden ecosystem, which is why many people ask us, what do you do about pests? We don't do anything about pests because we have this whole team, you know, of insects and birds which handle it. We don't have to do anything. So we don't have the problems that people who grow a monoculture face. So
we do have a problem with peacocks, so we have to throw stones.
Yeah, the peacocks are a part of the wildlife because we can't forget that we have 5.5 acres of forest here, and there's kind of a small wildlife which has made this a home. Mm-hmm. And so we also have rabbits. In the beginning, we could not grow corn and beans because the rabbits would eat them, you know. And now we have to chase the peacocks. So that kind of thing exists. I mean, it's there, but it's not a very big problem.
Beautiful, anyway.
The thing also is that we employ no workers. We have no mom in the house, so the place is very messy. And there are leaves and twigs and stuff lying everywhere. And so in between, seeds from different weeds, So when we started, there was only grass here, graminaceae, a few types of grass. And now we see all kinds of weeds have come up here, which, you know,
attract other animals, they just come
here, you know. Mm-hmm. And even a type of flower which can, its history can be brought to, surely to Joss's place, to, Pichandikulam, that medicinal plant
purple
that grows
one.
With a purple flower. All of a sudden, one day it grows here. And I think once when I was with Joss, I thought he told me that he had actually that in his medicinal garden thing. I'm not so sure, but I remember something like that.
It's quite possible because we never brought many plants and they just sort of mysteriously appeared. So we can't explain it, but we think maybe seeds came with birds, or we have no idea how they came, but we just have many kinds of plants now which we didn't intentionally plant.
That weed that is for snake bite and scorpion bite, what is this called again?
Oh yeah, that is...
I forgot the name.
Yeah, I forget the name of that.
That came all of a sudden. And now it's everywhere.
It's a medicinal plant, which is... in this area, they say that it's used for snake bite. But in the rest of the country, they use it for malaria, for malarial fevers. It's a highly medicinal plant, and it's a weed. Many of them... What about the one which is good for the eyes? This Ponnangani. Ah, that also came on its own. And so a lot of weeds and medicinal plants came on their own, we don't know how. And we keep them when we notice their value, and they grow like weeds, so we control them a bit if they are overgrowing other plants. But we just see it as a positive thing that, in any case, it's known that if your garden has a lot of weeds, that means it indicates a fertile soil.
It's a healthy soil, yeah.
So it's an indication, we take it positively.
That's good. And what are the main functions of your garden at the moment?
Right now, it's actually a home-based seed production garden, I'd say. More than seed production, I'd say seed conservation. So we conserve about 90 different plant varieties, which are useful for home gardeners, for home gardening. So this includes vegetables, root crops, herbs, medicinal plants, flowers, things that are very easy to grow here and that have done extremely well. So we've built up this collection of, most of them are unusual and uncommon varieties.
Unusual and uncommon.
Yeah, most of them are unusual, uncommon varieties, which you don't see in the markets, which nobody grows anymore, apparently.
And why is this? Why don't people grow these plants anymore?
It's difficult to say, but they just went out of production because they're not commercial, not considered commercially valuable, although there's no reason why some of these can't be commercialized. It's just that the research institutes and the companies, they develop a certain variety and they launch it, and farmers are encouraged to grow that rather than grow some of the traditional ones which could actually be equally good.
Yeah.
And so somehow this is pushed on the market scene, and then consumers also get used to buying and eating only one kind of vegetable, mm-hmm. and not the others. In fact, so much that we don't even know that you can have a red okra. We call it lady's finger here. That how many people have seen a red okra? There are very few Indians who know this, and it's such a common vegetable. We eat it all the time. And I mean, same thing, this kind of diversity is there in every vegetable. There's just so much that we don't even know of.
But there is also, for instance, snake gourd. And snake gourd is a very long fruit. It can be 1.5 meters long or more. It is very unpractical to transport in a lady's handbag. So they have developed short snake gourds. Or the bottle gourd. You know, we have only the club variety and not the biloba one, which takes a lot of place in your bag. Yeah. And that's why they make tomatoes a little square so that they can pack them. There is all kinds of strange reasons why traditional varieties go out of use. Also, for instance, as far as millets is concerned, nobody has ever done any effort to make a small mill to dehusk varagu or ragi or something like that, you know. It still has to be done by the stone or practices which are not convenient anymore, because the ladies also, girls go to school, ladies have a job, and so nobody wants to do the stone work in the house anymore, or pounding with the stick, you know. So there has been no effort to maintain these things. Yeah.
And do you distribute the seeds? You said something about it, but can you tell more about this?
We've devoted this garden for seed conservation. it wasn't our intention in the beginning. We just wanted to do it to like find out if we can grow food on this type of land. That was the main motivation. But when we succeeded, we sort of... I mentioned that we were part of an organic farmers network. Bernard started one called Arise, and the first meeting of Arise was in Oroville in 95. So ever since then, and even before that, he's been in contact with a lot of farmers from all over India. And they used to come for meetings. We organized meetings. They would come, and our seed collection began that way. They would bring us all these varieties, you know, and somebody would say, I have this is a red long bean, which I still have. It's now 13 years since we got that, and I'm still maintaining that variety. So we got our collection like this from different parts of India, from farmers and gardeners all over India. So, and we felt I was responsible. I mean, I realized that what I have in my hand is something that is rare and endangered, and I felt responsible to, you know, to preserve it and to share it. So a seed conservation garden makes sense only if you share the seeds. Otherwise, of what use is it? Yeah. So it's an important part of our work to share the seeds, and it's a lot of work. But since 2003, I started organizing myself better in seed distribution. I designed seed packets with an informative label, and I had a display with photographs, and I would take these seeds to organic farmers meetings whenever they were held in different parts of India. I still do it every year, 4-5 times a year at least, and we take this whole thing, make about 1500 seed packets, and go with this display and put it out and spread the seeds everywhere. So that's our main work, but that's one way in which we distribute seeds to people all over India. Then we also have a kind of an email list which we send to people whom we know, farmers whom we know, and then they write and ask, they make their requests. There are some friends we have who are working with seeds in remote areas, and so they know that we are doing this work, and they ask us to send seeds once a year for their women farmers, or like that. Our seeds go all over India.
Great. Yeah. And are the seeds distributed among our affiliates?
I have no organized way of distributing in Oroville, because I also feel in Oroville there's another very, very well organized seed bank called Annadana, which is associated with Association Kokopelli, and you probably know it's one of the planet's largest collections. It's absolutely stunning. So Aurovillians have the privilege of accessing these wonderful seeds from them, and I just feel I would like to share the seeds we grow with people who don't have this privilege.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah. And well, as a last question, I was wondering, do you have any remarks on the future of Autofuel and the position of food and sustainability?
Actually, Orville hasn't paid much attention to sustainability and to its self-sufficiency in food, and that is a very big minus point, actually. And the farms have to struggle. This is not nice, and I believe it was not intended. Once the mother told that she was the most crazy person on earth, that was in relation with a farm that she established called Gloria Farm. She said, I buy the land, I maintain the people, the farmers, I feed them, I pay for the inputs that they will need, and I buy their products on a price which is more than the market. So you must be totally foolish. But the fact that she did it, and the fact that she put so much importance for this whole thing, shows something. And I think we are lacking. We are not appreciating the effort that mother has done.
No.
Not at all. I find it actually a very big minus point.
So on what fields could there be improvement?
On all fields. Yeah, I know it's difficult. I mean, it's not an easy subject, but I think it's and it's in many things.
Yeah,
in many things of environment, Orville is not sustainable. It has nothing sustainable in it. So it's a little bit. We have so much land. We still cut rainforest for building our houses. Yeah. We still do a lot of things. We have the highest consumption in petrol, I think, per capita in India. We have the highest population of motorbikes or highest electricity consumption. I don't think we are consuming less electricity than people in Delhi or Bombay. I don't know, it could be calculated, it could be brought forward. I think we have the highest rate of computers or electronic equipment in, per capita. And if you see per capita, I think we are very brown.
So actually there are still quite some challenges for Arthurians on the sustainability aspect of living here.
And all this is not easy, it's easy to say, but it's not so easy to do. No. But there should be more will.
Yeah.
And in fact, it was mentioned, I believe, that Auroville is the city the earth needs. It was never said it's the city humanity needs or the world needs. It was the earth needs it. And we are not up to the point.
No,
I hope it will be improved in the future.
Yeah. I understand. Okay, thank you very much. I would like to ask you, do you have any things to add to this conversation which are not discussed yet?
There is a lot of potentiality in Auroville, and that potentiality is, I believe, not 100% used. And that would be, instead of doing all kinds of strange things, if we should, as a community, try to be more look at how we could organize and better organize our things, whatever we have, that would be a big step forward, because that's where the people who come here are looking for.
Yeah.
And they're looking for. Yeah.
Thank you.